off court, he was always like really good to talk to, and he wanted to know about our profession. Like from the beginning, you could sense like he wanted to know what's going on here in this whole circus.
My first contact with him was when he was 16. He just won the Wimbledon Junior title, and I chatted to him, and I said to him, the way you do with all juniors, okay, well, you've won the junior title. Do you think you might win the main title one day? And he sort of looked at me and said, yeah, why not?
I like to say when I speak about Roger, he was an old school player, but he brought the old school technique to the modern era, right? With the new rackets, the ability to hit the spin, you know, the one-handed back, and the kind of do it all at a time when tennis in some ways was really at a crossroads, but he managed to play old school style in the modern era. All right, welcome to another edition, everyone, of the Tennis Worthy podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I am Patrick McEnroe, very proud to be the president of the Hall of Fame. And we are just digging in this year to, of course, the one and only Mr. Roger Federer, who will be inducted into the Hall of Fame later this year. Chris Bowers, my right-hand guy, we've done a few of these already this year, the esteemed journalist, the brains behind this podcast. Chris, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
And also, we are very privileged to have with us Mr. Simon Graf, who has written, I'm trying to keep track, Simon, countless books on Mr. Federer. Is it three or four?
Three so far.
Three so far. Okay, a little tease for us. Maybe one more to come. Well, you have followed, I got to get into you here right off the bat, because you followed Roger, obviously, throughout his entire career. We'll discuss that. But I want to hear from you, Simon, the first time that you laid eyes on Roger Federer.
I think it was in Basel at the Swiss Indoors. Must have been 99 or 2000, when he was like either 18 or 19 years old. And we, all of us knew he was going to be a great player. And he was a really likable, nice guy. Like, he started to control his temper a bit better. And off court, he was always like really good to talk to, and he wanted to know about our profession. Like from the beginning, you could sense like he wanted to know what's going on here in this whole circus.
Interesting, right? I mean, I found that too, and I think I've told a couple of those stories already, so I'll leave it to you guys. But it is amazing how even when he was a teenager, he was like that, because I've always noticed how Roger's so interested in other people, in addition to obviously understanding, especially now, Chris, how popular he is. And we've touched on this topic before, but it is really incredible how much interest there is in Roger coming into the Hall of Fame, but just in who Roger Federer is now as a person who's retired from tennis.
I think that's right. I think part of it comes from the fact that Roger is incredibly interested in other people. And you might say that, well, what's that got to do with people being interested in him? But I do think that makes him very likable. I remember when I interviewed him when he was about 19. And at one stage I said to him, we were talking about South Africa because his mother's South African and he spent a lot of his childhood holidays in South Africa. And I said, So what do you think of the political situation in South Africa? And he said, well, I don't know. I mean, I'm only 19. I don't live there. He was absolutely right the way he answered that question. But it made me realize I'd assumed that he would have an opinion on most things, whereas he doesn't necessarily. He doesn't always have an opinion on things, but he's always willing to listen. Everybody he meets, he is willing to take the view they have something to teach me. My first contact with him was when he was 16. He just won the Wimbledon Junior title, and I chatted to him, and I said to him, the way you do with all juniors, okay, well, you've won the junior title. Do you think you might win the main title one day? And he sort of looked at me and said, yeah, why not?
You know, I have to tell you this quick story. So I'm not sure I've told it to Chris. I probably have, so forgive me, Chris, for repeating it. But I'm going to tell you, because you mentioned Basel. And Basel was one of the few tournaments I actually made the finals of at one point in my career. So I'm getting ready to interview Roger after he won Cincinnati when I'd become a broadcaster, courtside. And I said, Roger, he beat James Blake so easily in the final. And I said, can I ask you a lot of questions? Because we need to fill time here. He goes, oh, yeah, no problem. Don't worry about it. So we're sitting there after he, you know, was getting ready to do the ceremony, he looks at me and says, you know, I ball boyed for you. I said, excuse me? He goes, yeah, I ball boyed for you. And then obviously my brain, I said, must have been in Basel. He said, yeah, in the final. And I said, well, you must have been rooting for me, right? He goes, no, I was rooting for Wayne, because it was Wayne Ferreira, who was South African. But again, like the idea that, you know, here's this journeyman player in about to interview him and he remembered that. And it just made me feel like, you know, a bigger person, right? And I think that's something that he's done throughout his entire life, isn't it?
Absolutely. I remember when I ran into him two or three days after one of the Roland Garros losses against Rafa at the indoor pool at where I live. And I was there with one of my daughters. She was like 7 or 8, I suppose. And he took the girls to swimming lessons. He didn't swim himself. And so I just saw him in the cafeteria. I said, "Hey, Roger, you wanna have a coffee?" And he was fine to do that. So we chatted for about an hour. And after like 20 minutes, it was getting a little boring for my daughter. She didn't know tennis that well, you know. And of course, we were in Swiss German, talking Swiss German. And then he started questioning her, like, "What sports do you like?" And he sensed that like she wasn't comfortable anymore, and so it was like he talked with her like for 10, 15 minutes, and really wanted to know everything about school, etc. So there was like he wasn't supposed to do that, but he just wanted to engage her in the conversation, and then his girls came, and so he was a really like. Fun and just a very normal situation for my daughter. And I in the end I took a picture of her and him, and at that time she didn't really know how big Roger was, you know. And now it's in her bedroom, and it was a good experience.
You, Chris, you've seen so many of the greats in tennis. And it really is, it stands out, doesn't it? The personality of Roger Federer, in addition to, you know, we've waxed poetic, at least I hope we have, about his tennis skills and his game, but the way he's been able to just connect with people, right? And in addition to, as Simon said, one thing I admire about the big three just generally is the way they were able to deal with the losses, right? Because they had some epic losses, including Roger, the one where he lost to Nadal, and I think he won, what was it, 3 or 4 games in the Paris final. Maybe that was a year, Simon, and he still had his party with all the people that were there as his guests after that, you know, really the worst loss of his career. How was he able to balance that, being such a great competitor, but at the same time being as gracious too?
I think it's just part of the way he approached things. The fact that, you know, I don't think he particularly enjoyed doing press conferences, certainly not at the beginning, but he took the view it's part of the obligations, therefore we'll embrace it. And actually, especially when he lost, I always felt that his press conferences were part of the catharsis, the coming down off a defeat, because he was able to talk about it. He didn't particularly want to. Often the first couple of answers in his press conferences when he'd lost a match were quite short because he was irritated. And then as he got talking, you know, he became eloquent, coherent, and you could tell he was digesting it. And I think one of the things that struck me about Roger, I mean, I lived in Switzerland for 2 years, sort of start of 87 to the big end of 88. And I played a year of Swiss League tennis. And my doubles partner was Severin Luthi, who later on became one of Roger's coaches, or about the consistent assistant coach, if you like, throughout Roger's career. And I was aware of the Jakob Hlasek emergence, the first really big Swiss singles player. Heinz Günthert had won Wimbledon doubles, but you had Hlasek. Then you had Marc Rossi, who won the Olympic gold. Then you had Martina Hingis. But in a way, Switzerland was punching above its weight. And to have someone like Roger come up, because the Swiss are a very down-to-earth people, I hope I'm not saying anything impolite, Simon. I have a lot of time for the Swiss. They're a country with no raw materials, and therefore they are built on hard work. And therefore, I think that Roger was very much of the Swiss people. And it took a while before people really understood in Switzerland just how big he was. I mean, I used to go to the tournament in Basel in the early 2000s. When I was going in about 2014, 2015, 2016, you would see his photo on every advertising board, not in the early years. I think the Swiss just took him as somebody who, well, yes, he plays tennis. He's probably quite good, but, you know, you know, we don't put him on a pedestal like you put a Boris Becker or a David Beckham in another sport. And I think that was a big part of how he was able to be very humane. The world loved it. I think the Swiss took a while before they realized just how significant that was.
Yeah, maybe that's part of what kept it seemingly Roger grounded as much as he's been his whole career. All right, Simon, let's talk a little bit about the game, because you said when you first saw him, you said, well, this guy's going to be a great player. You could see the skills. I like to say when I speak about Roger, he was an old school player, but he brought the old school technique to the modern era, right? With the new rackets, the ability to hit the spin, you know, the one-handed backhand, the kind of do it all at a time when tennis in some ways was really at a crossroads, you know, the end of the beginning of the 2000s, you know, with the end of the era of Sampras, Agassi, or starting to be the end of that. And then you had Leighton Hewitt came through, you had the big servers, Philippoussis, even he's just part of the reason why Wimbledon changed the nature of the grass, right, to make it more of an all-court game. And then along comes this guy who can do it all. Because at that time, a lot of us were thinking, uh-oh, it's going to be all about the big servers, it's going to be all about power tennis. But he managed to play old school style in the modern era. When did you realize that he could do that?
Well, I mean, when he beat Sampras 2001 at Wimbledon, he played serve and volley.
Right.
He basically beat Pete at his game. And that was unbelievable to see. And so he could do that. And then in the following years, he became more of a baseline player with an aggressive attitude. Because he was so much better from the baseline. He didn't need to go to the net that often anymore. So I think it was, there's like three or four different Rogers throughout his career. First, like he really modeled his game after Pete. Then he just became really dominant from the baseline. And I think he was very stubborn to establish himself as number one, as the best from the baseline in every match. That was for him the key. And then when Rafa and Novak challenged him, he had to reinvent himself, which took a while. And it was very impressive to see him come back in 2017 after a six-month break after a knee injury and win the Australian Open. And for me, it was maybe the most fun Roger to watch because he was a... He played so aggressively, and there were a few matches against Rafa. He completely just brushed him off the court, and so he could do everything, but he had to figure out what to do. That was the key for him in the beginning. Like he didn't win a Grand Slam title at 19, like Carlos did. He was almost 22 when he won Wimbledon for the first time, because he had to figure out what kind of player am I, what are the strengths I really have to stick to, and maybe sometimes not play that fancy, but more efficient. And I think he became really efficient in his way of playing in the following years.
Yeah, that stubbornness you mentioned is pretty common, isn't it, in all-time greats? And maybe that was one thing, Chris, that held Roger back just a little bit before he made those changes to the racket, you know, to being more aggressive off the backhand. Because I remember I used to watch a lot of those matches. I was lucky enough to be there for pretty much all of them when he played Rafa. I used to say, why does he not run around more and hit the forehand on the second serve return? Why is he just trying to chip the backhand back? But again, it was sort of because he'd been so successful, right, for so long. But I think it did finally click in. And you've mentioned before, Ivan Ljubicic, you think really helped him make that adjustment.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Ljubicic was very big in terms of the final part of his career from the Australian Open in 2017. But, I mean, that stubbornness, I think that goes hand in hand, not just with great champions, but he wanted to keep improving. I mean, Rafa was like this as well. Rafa would say, every day, I just want to do something a bit better. And Roger was the same. I mean, we saw the stubbornness with, you know, he played some matches too much from the baseline when he could probably have won them more easily or challenged more. Sometimes I wonder what would have happened if he'd gone to the net a little bit more in those two finals he lost to Rafa at Roland Garros, 06 and 07, not the one in 08, because I think Roger was off then, and that was the one where Rafa won all but four games. I think Roger just, he wasn't Roger until about late August that year. But we saw it with the unwillingness to play the drop shot on clay. He would not have won Roland Garros in 2009 if he hadn't actually said, right, okay, I'm going to have to use the drop shot here, because he was very reluctant to do it. And then the going to the larger head size racket, he took a long time before he was persuaded to go for the bigger racket. I wonder whether he might have won two or three more Grand Slam titles had he switched a little bit earlier. But that's, you know, you can't criticize champions for being stubborn when being stubborn is one of the things that makes them champions.
Yeah, that's so true. Simon, let's dive in a little bit to the clay courts, because Roland Garros is coming up shortly, and Chris just mentioned, you know, finally Roger was able to win it finally for him. And, you know, in my view, he was clearly the second best clay court player in the world for many years. I think maybe Novak overtook him later in his career as well. But for a guy who was such a great grass court player and obviously great indoors and on quicker courts, he also loved to play on clay. It was almost like he enjoyed clay. I think maybe even more because his creativity could come out, but he always had that one guy in front of him that really prevented him from winning the tournament multiple times. But how big was that when he finally got over the hump and won in Paris?
That was a big relief for him. And I remember when in 2009, when Robin Söderling beat Rafa, he knew this could be my year. And I think the following round he played Tommy Haas, and he was down two sets to love, and he was behind in the third or something like that. So he was like, he could have lost, but somehow he won that match. And
we had just, sorry to interrupt you, but we had Tommy Haas on an earlier podcast this year. And trust me, he remembers what happened, that exact shot that Roger hit, one of those inside out forehands that landed just inside the line, the sideline, on a huge point that I think Tommy would have then served for the match. Right, Chris?
Yes, Tommy came within 5 points of winning that match.
It was like 4-3 break point, I think, in the third. Anyway, keep going, Simon.
So Roger was really, I think he sensed, okay, this is my year. This could be my year. But so he became a little nervous. And he told me after he won, like all the people were approaching him. And obviously everyone wanted him to win in Paris because he has such a flair. They love his style. He speaks French really well because he was in Équipe Blanc in the academy for a few years. And so he's really good at French. And every time someone said, yeah, now this is your time, Roger, he became more nervous and more nervous. I think he had a really tough semifinals against Juan Martín del Potro as well. He was down 2-1. And when he finally made it to the finals, I think it was he knew, oh, now I can really reach it. And he played phenomenal in the finals against Robin Söderling. But I mean, I remember all those years when he lost to Rafa. All those finals, obviously, as a Swiss journalist, you were a little biased. You would have loved him to win. And I sensed that it always rained on that Sunday evening, and we were walking back to the Port d'Auteuil, and it was the rain,
the conditions didn't favor him because it got heavy conditions, right?
Yeah, and the whole thing kind of matched our moods after he lost time and again, and he never beat Rafa in Paris.
But Patrick, I think the interesting thing is that Switzerland tennis 1990s, when Roger was growing up, was virtually all clay. There were a few indoor centres with carpet courts, but essentially it was all clay. So he grew up on clay. Yes, there was in Basel, there was the indoor centre. It was known as Paradis, owned by Roger Brennwald, the impresario behind the Basel tournament. He got the chance to play on some fast indoor courts there in winter. But by and large, it was clay. The club he played at, the Old Boys Club, I think they have 9 courts. They're all red clay. So in some ways, it's remarkable. In a way, the same with Becker and Edberg. They played fundamentally on clay. But in winter, because of the weather, they were able to play on fast indoor courts. And therefore, they developed a decent indoor game. But Roger really should have won Roland Garros well earlier than he did. And I think he would have done. You know, if he lost 05, 06, 07, 08 to Rafa, a semi-final and three finals. And if it hadn't been for the greatest clay quarter of all time, I think Roger Roger would have been in the mid-20s, having won Roland Garros much earlier than he did.
Right. Well, the other guys can make the same argument about Roger, but there you go. That's what we love.
Later they can.
Yeah. All right, Simon. So now I'm hoping, based on your first answer to me, that you've got another book in the works on Roger, because it's really been... I mean, I can't say I'm surprised at how popular he still is, but it seems to me, kind of from the outside looking in, and, you know, I've spoken to Roger a couple of times about this Hall of Fame weekend, which he's very much looking forward to and really wants to help the Hall of Fame as much as he can. So we're very appreciative of that. But how his popularity, it seems like it's just bigger than it's ever been. Can you help us understand why?
Well, I think... He was born to play tennis, and he was born to be in the whole, like, he just loved everything about it, not only playing tennis, but he was really himself, like talking to people, meeting people, traveling around the world. I think even doing interviews was okay for him. So I think he just felt so comfortable with the whole lifestyle of tennis. And I think that resonates with the people, because they see someone who is really, he does what he's supposed to do in this world. Like it could happen in other professions as well. Like if you see a baker, or if you see an artist, like they are really, they just feel so comfortable at what they're doing. And I think that resonated with all the people. And he never really, I think he was just very authentic all the time. And I think people sense that, and that's apart from his game. I think they just love him as a person. And now, I mean, he's made himself quite rare in tennis. And I think he's done it quite well. Now, every time you see him somewhere, it's a big happening. So like in Wimbledon.
When he shows up, yeah.
When he shows up, it's like everyone is goes crazy. And, you know, I didn't have an interview with Roger for quite some time until I met him last October, I think, when he was inducted to the Tennis Hall of Fame. And so we spoke for 45 minutes, and I really realized how much I missed him, because he has such good vibes, good energy, and I think people love his energy. He just loves life. He loves people. He loves even now when he's not playing tennis anymore. You can really feel he's at ease. He's perfectly fine. He doesn't think about any lost finals or any statistics. He's just completely fine with life, and I think that's good to see from someone.
Yeah, he's someone that you point out other professions. He loved his craft. Right. Roger loved to play tennis. And, you know, I think back, Chris, to, you know, I have one in my household who was a great champion, too, who I wouldn't say he loved tennis all the time. He loved, you know, but you think of him, you think of Jimmy Connors, you know, who loved to compete, who loved to battle. You know, Pete Sampras loved to win. I'm not going to say I don't think he really loved tennis. Andre Agassi sort of came to peace with it. But Roger obviously loved to play, loved to compete, loved to win. But he loved just to be on the court. And I still see that when I see him, you know, at the Laver Cup, he comes out and he hits a few balls. He does a clinic. He just loves to hit the tennis ball.
Yeah.
You're right. He does. I think, though, for him, it's sport rather than tennis. Tennis is where he found his calling. But I did an interview with one of his primary school teachers many years ago. And she said... One day someone said to me, oh, yeah, little Roger, he plays tennis. And she said, oh, does he? Oh, I had no idea. I thought he was a footballer. I thought he was a soccer player. And she said, I'd seen him. He takes the ball inside his own half and he runs and he beats a couple of midfielders and a couple of defenders and scores a goal. And so he was clearly somebody who just loved being in that sporting environment. And when he was 13, he had to choose. You know, he was clearly going to be good enough to do one of them professionally. And he had to choose, and he chose tennis, thank goodness. And I think that was the right choice, even though we don't have a parallel universe to see how he would have been in football. But he clearly loved that environment.
Simon, we're hoping that we see you at the induction weekend in Newport, which will be right before the main draw, the U.S. Open starts. So we hope you'll be there. We know there's going to be lots of Hall of Famers. Roger's even going to play in an exhibition match, which is going to be great on the grass at Newport with some other Hall of Famers. So I've been talking to quite a few to try to get them to come and play. So it'll be a lot of fun. But I have a feeling it'll be very emotional for Roger. You know him well. How do you think he's going to handle that whole weekend and that moment he gets up on that stage to give his speech?
I don't expect him to cry. I think he'll be well prepared. He will not be overwhelmed, but I think I'm really looking forward to his speech. And he delivered a great speech, a college speech. So I think he will put everything into perspective, and I'm really looking forward to see him there. But I think he'll be handling his emotions okay.
Okay. I'm not sure of some other people may not agree with that, but we shall see. Looking forward to it, Chris. What do you think it'll be like? I mean, you've been at the induction many times. This one, you know, the ticket sold out in record time in under 2 minutes. The demand is crazy. So what do you think the vibe will be that weekend? We're hoping the weather is good.
Sure. I mean, the thing is, wherever Roger goes, he is the center of attention. People want to see him. And therefore, I don't think it will be, if I say it won't be as big a deal for him, I think he will really respect it and appreciate it. But it's something that he will take in his stride more easily. That's why, although I'm not sure I agree with Simon, I fully understand what Simon's saying. I think he may well have his emotions under control, simply because this kind of event is something that he is used to handling. But I do think this is very special for him. The whole point behind the Laver Cup, which he founded, I mean, we call it the Laver Cup, but it's really the Federer Cup. The whole thinking behind that was to honour the history of those who've gone before. And here he has a chance to be the centre of attention at this institution that guards tennis's history and that celebrates tennis's great champions. And I think Roger will be totally in his element. Simon said a few minutes ago that, you know, one of the reasons why people warm to him is he's just so in his element. He's doing what he's supposed to do. And I think this so fits with what Roger is all about and his view of tennis that I think he'll be quite humbled by it, to be honest. He will just say, I am one of many people who've passed through this sport, and you know, there will be people after me as well.
Yeah, that's for sure. Looking forward to the time when Mr. Nadal comes in, maybe Serena Williams in the not too distant future, that we don't know if she's going to come back or not. All right, Simon, before I let you go, and we appreciate your time here on the Tennis Worthy podcast, Chris and I especially, if you were, don't tell us any secrets, but if you were, you've written 3 books on Roger throughout his career. If you were to write another one, what do you think would the premise would be about if you were to, you know, tease us with something about another book on Roger? What would you want to write about him now?
Well, if I would write another book, I would be happy to assist Roger in telling his own story in his own words. That I would really love to do. What we did in our last book was the Roger Federer effect. We spoke to many people how Roger had affected their lives, which I found was very interesting because it shows you how on many levels he really impacted lives of different people, of his rivals, of his friends, of people he never met. And I'm not sure he wants to do it, but if he needed a ghostwriter, I would be happy to assist him.
Join the line of people, Simon.
Yeah, exactly. That's a long list. But, you know, go back to your club. Maybe you'll run into him at the cafeteria again.
Absolutely, yeah.
Chris, before we wrap up, closing thoughts on Roger. We're going to do another, I think we'll do a round table or two, as we should, leading into Wimbledon. And I'll tell you one little quick a funny comment that was said to me by Alan Mills after Roger won his first Wimbledon, beating Philippoussis, and my partner that I was calling the match with, Cliff Drysdale, actually had tears in his eyes when Roger won. And I looked at him. I said, why are you crying? He was moved by Federer. And he said, this guy's incredible. And like, he was literally moved like in a positive way to tears. But Alan Mills, I saw him on the little balcony, you know, where the players, you know, walk to their player area. And he always liked to go out and have a smoke. So he was smoking a cigarette. And I said, wow, Alan, I said, that was really something. And I said, how many of these you think he can win? And he looked at me and he took a little puff of his cigarette and he said, as many as he wants.
Yeah, there's a lot in that. And, I think Roger was just, was as a player, but he's still around. And in fact, that's the next part of the life story, that I think there is still something in Roger's life that hasn't yet been told. What Roger did, and we forget, when he won Wimbledon in 2003, everybody knew about his talent. But by that stage of his career, people were saying, is he one of these incredibly talented people who will never quite get it all together? Because he'd lost, you know, the early stages or the middle stages of a number of Grand Slam tournaments. And I think what that triumph was in 2003 was him saying, I'm not just a beautiful player. I can actually put it together and be an effective player. And final comment, Simon said earlier about Roger's happy what he was doing. I did an interview with somebody who hasn't featured much in the Federer story, even though he was the guy who taught Roger to play tennis. He's a Czech guy called Sepli Kachovsky, after he retired, he disappeared. And I don't know where he is now, but he doesn't give any interviews these days. But I talked to him, back in the mid-2000s. And he said to me, the guy's just happy. He's doing what he wants. He's completely fulfilled. What else do you want from him? And I just thought to myself, yeah, we all need to strive for that.
Simon, put on your journalist hat and find this guy. I want to get him on the next podcast to find out, was he the first coach for Roger, Chris?
Yes, he taught Roger how to play tennis. There was another coach around that time, Peter Carter, but Peter was, he was more the team captain who then became the coach, but Sepli actually taught Roger the forehand and the backhand.
All right, Simon, we need you to do, and then we need to get you to Newport, so we're going to work on that on our end.
Yes, I'd love to come.
We appreciate you being part of the podcast. Appreciate all the stuff you've done on Roger. And we'll look forward to maybe one more. Simon Graf, Chris Bauer is here on the Tennis Worthy podcast.